Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's been a strange summer and a strange fall, weather-wise, and that affects all kinds of things, including birds. But birds are also on a clock that has less to do with the particular weather over a couple of weeks and more to do with the changing hours of daylight. For geese and other migratory birds, there's something called Zugenruhe. Don't worry, I had never heard of it either. Bird diva Bridget Butler told me about it for But Why, our podcast for kids, last fall. It's a German word for that restless feeling birds start to get as the seasons change. I think we can all relate. Or maybe I'm just projecting. Anyway, today we're going to explore Zugenruhe and other interesting words and birds. And I am joined, as always, by the effervescent birding enthusiast, Bridget Butler. Bird diva, nice to see you.
Oh, so great to be back, Jane.
So, Zugenruhe?
Oh, my goodness. Give me a good word like that to put out there to people, because it's just so fun. Zugenruhe. Yeah, that just anticipation kind of feeling. And we get it too with the change of seasons from summer into the fall. Although, like you said, it was a little wonky this year.
Yes,
those 90 degree days, I think they messed the birds up as well as us. And it's accompanied by this other thing called hyperphagia, where you just want to eat a lot. Do you ever feel like
never.
That? Like you
I
just
have
want to
never
stuff
had
your
that feeling
with lots
ever.
Of food. And the birds are, you know, so they've got this migratory restlessness going on, and then this feeling of, oh my gosh, I got to eat a lot. And that's to basically be able to bulk up to make some of these migratory passages that they've got to make.
That's not my excuse.
No, me neither. I know. I don't really have an excuse.
So they have this feeling, and really, I mean, that's it. It's just this sort of feeling like, I gotta get going, I gotta get going, you gotta eat, gotta go,
yeah.
gotta go.
And then they go, and right, so going, and this is the thing that always fascinates me about going, which those that set of 90 degree days really made me stop and take notice. So, you know, the other thing that they're waiting for is, when is it going to be easy to migrate? When is it going to be easier on my body? So I get this anticipatory feeling, this restlessness. It keys me into that it's time to leave, it's time to eat a lot, so I bulk up. But then when am I going to do that so it's easy? So if you've put on a lot of weight, right, as a bird that needs to be able to make this big journey, some birds to South America, that's a lot of extra weight to carry. So you want to do it at a time of day when it's going to be easier for you. So for small songbirds, and actually for the geese as well, it's at night when the air temperatures are cooler, and the density of the air isn't as thick as well, so it's easier for them to fly. Other birds like raptors, and I was watching a little bit of this yesterday when the sun came out and things started to warm up a little bit. So we get these thermals that happen and the air warms, and birds like hawks, bald eagles, broadwings, some of our occipiters, those guys that are going to leave the area are using thermals along the ridge lines to be able to gain elevation and then cruise down to the next hilltop or thermal to catch that, and that helps them go. Here's the smart thing too, right? So songbirds at night, raptors during the day, you got this predator prey thing. Uh-huh. They're trying to avoid each other because, you know, you don't want to get eaten. You don't want to be one of those ones that gets eaten on the way, especially on your first trip.
Yeah, that would be a bummer.
Yeah. And most of them aren't going to make it. So that's kind of all of these baby birds from this year, you know, maybe one or two of them are going to make it back. So you have this big brood. And then there are all these things that are kind of in the way of success. And
beyond predation, what else?
Yeah, so beyond predation, you know, one of the big things I talk to people about is just habitat stopovers. Where can the birds kind of come down, refuel, rest, have really good cover? And for some of, actually, for all of us, it can be our backyard. I am always amazed at what I get in downtown St. Albans. Our big backyard list, some of you might know that my family and I, we keep a list of all the birds that we see or hear. You have to have your feet in our backyard or our front yard, you know, somewhere on the property. We're almost up to 60. I think we're around 57 species. And I'm always amazed during the spring and fall migration at the diversity of birds that we get coming through. And the main reason in our yard is because we've got a stream on the border of our property. We have a good set of both deciduous trees and coniferous trees. And we have some great shrubs, and I'm trying to build up the amount of shrubs that we have that provide native berries. So things like viburnums and dogwoods that have a berry that's high in lipids and fats, all of that, that is going to help those birds satisfy the Zuckenruhe hyperphagia feeling.
Right, because so, we're not supposed to have feeders up.
No, yeah, I know. And people have been asking about feeder stuff lately, and I'm like, come on, people. It's not October 1st yet, so what are you doing with your feeders?
Although
out?
Now I guess it is.
Now
I
we're good.
November 1st.
We're in the good zone. I know, and we do have to keep pushing that date back, right? Because
90-degree weather does not make bears want to hibernate.
The bears
either.
Are not going to go into hibernation. And if you're in an area where, you know, the bears aren't moving through regularly, it's probably all right to have feeders out.
We're talking with Bridget Butler. It's the Bird Show. Bridget, you were mentioning a moment ago raptors and catching a thermal and sort of riding it. And we got a note from Will in Canaan, New Hampshire, who says, hiking up Smarts Mountain from Lyme, New Hampshire, I watched in awe a dozen or so ravens playing in a thermal.
Nice.
For at least 20 minutes, they corkscrewed in a queue from a few hundred feet above the ground to about 1,000 feet above the ground. Reaching the apex, the top bird would go limp as if shot and killed by a shotgun blast. It would tumble down through the rising gaggle, wings flopping and body twisting, until regaining control at the bottom. There, it reclaimed its place in line with its competition to thermal back up, repeating its plunge again and again. Have you observed or can you explain this behavior in birds?
Yes. No, I haven't seen it, though. But this is this is an exciting story. This is great. Thank you for sharing this. So, right, we know that crows and ravens are super playful, super smart, and social, right? They love to play together. So I'm really not surprised to hear that that's the bird that you saw doing this. And I'm psyched that you got to see this. That's pretty amazing. So these guys are kind of doing that same thing. And what's really cool about this kind of spiral that he described, we call it a kettle. Normally, it's like a kettle of hawks. And once one bird catches that thermal and starts to spiral up, other birds can see that. And so then they join it and they're like, okay, that's where the next thermal is. So if you imagine a little posse of ravens hanging out together, one bird notices this and goes up. And then that going limp at the top, that's just awesome. Man, I wish I could... that moment, right, where you're like, oh, can I be that bird? That would be so cool.
That just sounds like playing. I mean, they're not exactly migrating if they're just doing this sort of...
They're just having some fun.
Yeah, it's like an amusement park ride.
That's exactly it. Just like an amusement park ride. What I did get to see this year that I thought was really, really pretty cool, and I can't remember the last time I had this happen, at Doe Camp this year, which is sponsored by Vermont Outdoors Woman, we hiked up Brousseau Mountain, which is over near the Averill Ponds up in the Northeast Kingdom. And when we got to the top... right away when we were looking out over Averill Pond, it wasn't obvious that there were any migrating raptors there. And then all of a sudden, one of the women said, look down below us. And so from our vantage point, we were above where the turkey vultures were starting to catch the thermal to ride up above us. And that view of, you know, we always see turkey vultures from below, but to get to see this bird from above was really pretty amazing. It's just kind of one of those perspective shifts that you're like, oh. So one of those great things to take advantage of is paying attention to what birds are doing during different times of year, so then you can be in the right place at the right time to enjoy it.
Well, speaking of right place at right time, for Lori, it seems to be all the time. She says, I'm wondering why I'm hearing barred owls again every night. I heard them so often in the spring, but not much through the summer. So why now?
Okay, so in the summer, you got to stop and think. So spring, what are they doing? They're trying to get their groove on, right? So they're calling to each other, trying to pair up. And then once they pair up, they're going to have babies. And then it's like, okay, everybody be quiet. So we're quiet. We're raising our young. The babies fledge. Then they go into that. The next set of sounds that you start to hear are the begging fledgling calls. That they go, see-up, see-up. It's like the scariest sound for babies
really creepy.
Begging. I'm glad our kids don't beg like that for like cheese sticks and stuff, right? We call ours the pterodactyls, but so it's close. So quiet through the summer. And then when fall comes again, some of those young birds are like, trying to test out their voices. Also, barred owls tend to be really social. They kind of break that thing of we're going to stay in our place and sing, you know, or call only during these certain times. And they like to talk it up with each other. And so,
they are territorial, right?
Yep, they are. And that's the other thing that's great is like if you have a pair that have been there and are mating there, you hear them over and over again, you can really kind of get to know them and get to know what their patterns are.
We have them all summer, too, and it just every night I go out and I can hear them, and it's a wonderful, wonderful sound. I love the barred owls. Patrick says, can you ask Bridget what's up with pileated woodpeckers? Mine have been cackling up a storm for weeks. Is it the young working out territory?
Yeah, there you go. So, and I paid a lot of attention to this this summer. It was really fun for me. Again, you know, since having, you know, kids, I can't get out and bird as much as I have been. So I'm kind of working on this whole theory of slow birding in my head where it's like I'm going to bird where I'm at and I'm going to do a little bit deeper observation with whatever I've got in front of me. And so this year for me, where I was at and during the time of the summer, I really started to notice how the song from the summer or from the spring of all the mating sounds, the different mating songs for territory and finding a mate then shifted and got quieter. And then there was this nice peak toward the end of June and into July and August where it was like family units. And I really got into following little family units and listening to their little call and sip notes. And as we got toward the end of the fall, and I can't help but smile every time I think of this, are the young juveniles that have finally fledged. They get their feathers in, they're feeling a little cocky, and they're like, now I'm going to try my song on. And they don't have it right, right? And you hear that white-throated sparrow that's like, poor Sam Peabody, and doesn't quite have it right. And you're like, you're a juvenile. I know it. I can just hear it.
You know, we were talking about owls and ravens, and you were talking about thermals. We have another hawk question. Sweet. Since we're in this sort of this wheelhouse at the moment. Robert says, over the past few weeks, we've been hearing screeching sounds that are made by two hawks. When we first heard them, they were in the tall maple trees close to our rural home. When we went out, they would fly. Recently, I regularly hear the sound, only they are flying near the house. We did have a few tall maples that were dying removed a few weeks ago. Mm. Any ideas about why they're making this screeching sound? I think they're red tails.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it sounds like, so if you have a pair, once again, it could be like family dynamics. There could be another threat or other raptor in the area, or even ravens and crows that are like, they're kind of getting in each other's faces. And so that shrieking happens. But then you also mentioned a little bit of habitat change there. And so that can really kind of change the way birds are going to behave and kind of react to an area that they've been familiar with for a while. I don't know. That's a good one. But I'm going to guess that it's kind of that end of season family kind of testing out different voices and such.
Rick in Westford says, I get grosbeaks at my feeder every spring. First the adults, then the fledglings. After a few weeks, I never see them again. Same with juncos. They're at the feeder all winter, but I never see one in the summer. Where do these birds go? Are they still in my area or do they fly far away?
Right on. What a great observation. That's really great. And those are two birds, and I'm hoping he's talking about evening grosbeaks. So we have rose-breasted grosbeaks, which have that nice bright pink splotch, black and white, kind of like tuxedo with a nice pink splotch on the breast. And then we have evening grosbeaks, which are like super dapper black and white, and then this really cool yellow color. And then he also mentioned the dark-eyed junco in there. So dark-eyed juncos and the evening grosbeaks are birds that both like spruce fir and tend to be either, you know, either in more boreal forests or up in higher elevations. And so we tend to see them shift depending on the time of year, the food source, and where they're going to breed. So those guys came to your feeder in the spring because they probably needed some food because there weren't a lot of food sources available at that point. Then they're going to shift to where they're going to be nesting and into their more kind of breeding territories or habitats. And now is the time when they're going to start to move back out again. So juncos do this really cool thing where they're up in higher elevations during the summertime, and then they come down into the lower elevations during this time of year. And one of the really cool resources that's out there that I try to keep up with and post on my Bird Diva Facebook page is BirdCast, which is from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And what it is it's a prediction of when migrants are going to move through different regions. And I love this because I like looked at it this morning and I was like, oh, no wonder I was seeing golden crowned and ruby crowned kinglets in my yard, because this is the time when they're going to start to move. Now, you may say to yourself, well, how do we really know that? And the way that we know that is by people sharing their observations to sites like eBird. And so what BirdCast does is they take eBird observations and then they make predictions based on when birds are going to be moving through different areas, arriving into an area or departing an area. And it's just really fun. I'm just constantly amazed at what we're able to pull out of that information. So when you have like a little flurry of birds in your backyard, that's like really valuable data. And so getting into eBird and learning how to upload your sightings there can really be helpful and provides great excitement for me as I go through the BirdCast data each week and share it with all of you.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm here today with bird diva Bridget Butler. We're talking all things birds, and we're going to talk a little bit more about how this strange weather we've had, including hurricanes in other parts of the country and the region, have affected bird migration. Sarah wrote in to say, I am deeply concerned about the destruction of the migratory bird winter habitat by recent hurricanes and tropical storms in the southern U.S. and the Caribbean. How will the already tenuous populations of these birds survive the winter and then return to their summer breeding grounds?
Yeah, I know. So So here's the good news. We don't know yet. We don't know how.
That's the good news?
That's the good news. Like, we're not sure how strong the impact has been. I was online this morning looking at pictures, and I did get a little choked up looking at before and after shots of some of the forests on some of the Caribbean islands, and just thinking about the waves of birds that are leaving here and using those islands either as their final destination for wintering or their stopover point before they try to make that leap to South America. So there is a lot of good news out there. So there's been some good news, and one of the great organizations that you can follow is Birds Caribbean. So the Vermont Center for Eco Studies works very closely with them on some of their work with some of our migratory birds here that end up there, that are their birds as well. And so you can go to their website, and they've been posting a lot of really great stuff on their blog. So help me with this island, Barbuda. Is that right?
Yeah.
So one of the islands there's a warbler, the Barbuda warbler, which they were worried was in such small numbers that it had disappeared. And a number of birders went out and they were able to find it.
Okay.
So there's a number of things that are happening. So there is a fund that is kind of being generated to be able to help Birds of Caribbean do some work to help find birds, and then also support them. So there's a whole group of people that are trying to put and get hummingbird feeders out there, because some warblers actually will drink from hummingbird feeders and will drink the nectar. So they're also trying to not only provide a food source that's now been wiped out for some of our migratory birds, but if you think about some of the endemic birds to those regions too, they rely heavily on a lot of different flowers for that. So we have about, I know, of 150 around migratory birds that either winter or stop over in some of those islands. And so, yeah, I think they're going to struggle, but there are people on the ground there that are trying to do things that will lessen the impacts and then also study the impacts moving forward.
Let's go to Paul, who's calling in from Concord. Hi, Paul. Go right ahead.
Hi. I went out of the house a few days ago and heard a lot of birds up in the trees near the house and walked out in the woods. They were way, way, way up in the canopy squawking. And they, as I walked toward them, they heard me. They kept shifting. I couldn't get a look at them. I initially thought they might be starlings, but would it be a time of year where I might see grackles migrating? And I actually have I took some video. I have a recording if you wanted to hear the sound.
Oh, sure. If you can play it easily, go right ahead, Paul.
Sure.
Sounds like a bunch of rusty hinges.
Paul, that's really cool. Thanks. What do you think, Bridget?
That's awesome. So to me, that rusty hinge sound says blackbird family. So you've either got starlings, grackles, and the other possibility is actually red-winged blackbirds. And so these guys start to flock up. They form those large flocks that sometimes you can find cool videos of online called murmurations, and they all kind of move and shift together. I saw a really cool one yesterday on the back roads in Fairfax, kind of moving over some of the fields. And they're going to move into treetops to kind of roost and then down into fields where there might be waste corn or even, oh my gosh, the wild rice up at the Missisquoi National Wildlife Refuge is a really great spot to go and look for some of these different blackbird murmurations. So yes, blackbird family for sure. So
it could be grackles. It's not too early for grackles.
Nope.
Okay. Brian and Jericho emailed in to say, please remind everyone it's recommended to feed birds only during the wintry months. The Vermont Fish and Wildlife website provides information about when to feed and care and maintain your feeders, how to maintain them. And on that note, let's go to Michelle calling in from Stowe. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a similar question. I was wondering what the optimum time was to feed birds. I was concerned about making migratory birds dependent on the food source. So what do you recommend as the optimum times to feed birds?
Sure. So, and you know, the dates that we used to use for feeding birds was not feeding them April through October. So feeders can go out in October, and then you want to pull them in April. And that was for bears. I know we've kind of started to push that back a little bit because as we have warmer falls, we just want to pay attention to the facts that, that bears may not be going into habitation or hibernation as early as they normally do when the weather gets colder. So I would say October 1st and beyond is all right. If you're in a place where there are bears and it's still warm, think about putting it off a little bit more. Leave your gardens messy. You don't have to hack off all those seed heads. They provide great places for insects. And the seeds themselves are there for the birds afterwards to be able to feed on. And don't worry about messing up migration. In fact, you're probably helping them. So the birds that you're seeing that might be coming to your feeder right now that are migratory birds might be needing just a little bit more of a kick from your suet or whatever, but you're not going to change their migratory patterns. And it's the same thing with our birds that are resident birds. Although we do want to be sensitive, especially during the colder months, about being consistent in our feeding, you're not going to harm a bird or keep them from doing what they normally do. Bird seed or bird feeder visits are like maybe a quarter of their diet, but that's just a small part. They're going to get, you know, just like we're supposed to eat from all the different food groups, birds are trying to do that as well, and they are still finding insects and caterpillars and things like that under leaves and under bark that are the larger part of their diet.
So the only reason there's sort of a prohibition on feeding the birds is because of other wildlife like bears.
Yes. Yep.
Otherwise, you'd be fine. If you live in an area with no bears, you can, I mean, in theory, you could feed them all summer long.
Yes, in theory, you could feed them all summer long.
So if you're in an apartment with a porch in Winooski or Burlington or Brattleboro or wherever, you can set it out.
Downtown St. Albans, like I am. Yeah. So you could put that out. Sure.
Those of us in Moncton cannot.
Oh.
We have bears.
Yes, bears. Big time.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Kathy in Wethersfield. Hey, Kathy.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
While I was on a walk, I saw a barred owl perched on the side of the road, and then a second barred owl flew in with a mouse and gave it to the other one.
Yes.
I just wondered what that kind of behavior is for.
Was that recently?
A couple years ago.
What time of year?
I think it would have been possibly after they had their young, but still, you know, early summer.
Yeah, so I think you've got your answer right there. So, again, this summer, I just had a blast watching parents feed babies. And, you know, early in the summer season, you can see that they're still babies, right? They have their somewhat adult feathers coming in, but there's still those, like, little downy feathers, like, sticking up that make them look kind of awkward and geeky. And so you're like, oh, yeah, you're still begging for food. But you get into the end of July, and you can tell the parents are getting a little tired of it. And those little fledgling, you know, the downy feathers aren't there anymore. And now it looks like an adult feeding an adult. And the baby's still squawking, and you'll notice that the adults start to ignore the baby. And it's kind of like, no, go get your own food, or I'm going to show you how to do this. So it's likely that what you saw was an adult bird feeding a fledged barred owl.
My favorite thing is when the babies are sort of poofy and they're bigger looking than their parents.
Yeah.
And so you see these enormous babies still trying to sort of mooch off the parents who are sleek and smaller. And the babies are like, no, feed me.
Now, and then there's the part where you really want to look. If it's a really big baby and a smaller adult, that might be a cowbird baby.
Mm.
So cowbirds are the ones that are lazy or smart, depending on how you look at it. They drop their egg in a bird's nest of another species, and that bird tends to hatch earlier, gets bigger faster. And I actually got some great pictures from a photographer this year of cowbirds and some of our winged warblers, which are a little bit more unique and rare, blue-winged and golden-winged, feeding cowbirds, and just how big the cowbird was compared to the little warbler.
I'm thinking of the barn swallows that were in our little barn this year. They were pretty cute.
Nice.
I don't think that was a cowbird.
And they have those giant mouths too, right? And the mouth, when they open up, this was the other thing I noticed. There was one day when I didn't have my glasses on and I was birding, and I could see this family of sapsuckers. But I could see this red, and it kept flashing. And I was like, why is the red flashing? Well, it was the young babies opening and closing their mouths. So the interior of their mouth is brightly colored in order to give the parents that target to ensure that they are going to get whatever the parents have brought.
Let's go to Judy in St. George. Hey, Judy.
Thank you. I live on about 100 acres. And last winter, for the first time, I put out a bird feeder, and not a single bird came.
Huh.
So I need help.
Okay. So
I did wait until after I thought the bears would be gone.
Okay. And where did you put the feeder in relation to your home?
Well, I put it right on a particular window, and it is sort of... the house juts out from that window, so there are short walls on either side of it.
Mm.
So the bird, it's sort of a sheltered, enclosed place.
Yeah. One of the things to keep in mind when you put bird feeders out is thinking about how birds feed. And I love watching the birds come to our feeder, and we do have one that's fairly close to our house. But we've placed it where there's a spruce tree and then a hedgerow nearby, because there are some birds like chickadees, for example, which is normally the bird that's going to find your feeder first. Chickadees come in and take a seed and then they leave with it, and they need to go and find cover fairly quickly in order to feel safe coming to and from that feeder, because they're not going to sit at the feeder and eat the seed. So having a feeder someplace where you have good cover, either a shrub or a conifer nearby that they can take cover in to feed. Nuthatches do the same thing. Likewise, other birds that like to perch need a place to be able to easily and quickly disperse from, so they're not going to bang into other things. So if you have the feeder tucked in somewhere where their sides, it sounded like that, maybe there was like a corner part to your house, the birds can't disperse easily, say, if a sharp-shinned hawk comes in and decides it wants to feed on the goldfinches. So they need a place to be able to leave the feeder quickly and then, again, gain some cover right away. So I would experiment with some different spots in your backyard. Again, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology website has this really great feature that you can find. It's where, how to place my feeder. And basically, it lets you type your address in, and then it uses Google Maps, and you can say, I want to put a feeder here in my backyard, and it will tell you whether or not that's a safe enough distance from your house.
Really?
Yeah, it's really cool. So the rule kind of is...
That sounds so Big Brother-y, though.
I know, it is kind of creepy, but it's fun. So if you don't want to go the Big Brother route, just think 3 and 30. So you want to have it within 3 feet of your house or more than 30 feet away from your house, because that has to do with window strikes. So if birds are trying to disperse quickly, if it's within 3 feet, they're not going to gain enough momentum to like hurt themselves. Once you get like beyond that 3 feet, like 5 feet away doesn't seem like much, but it's enough so that if that bird disperses quickly and it hits your window, it can get hurt. So then you want to go 30 feet out from the closest window.
Wow, very cool. All right, Judy, good luck this winter, and let us know what you find. Bridget will probably be back in the spring, and if she's willing. So we'll ask you again. You can let us know how it goes this winter. We got a note from Jane, who says, I want to pass on an amazing incident that happened a week and a half ago. First of all, I need to mention that my favorite songbird is and has always been the winter wren. Mm. It's such a small, obscure bird that sings a symphony-like song. So the other morning at sunrise, I was awoken by a chirp. Lo and behold, I saw a small bird sitting on a pillow on my bed that scurried to a shelf and the windowsill and hopped all around my room. I was so tired, and I decided to work on letting it out later in the morning. The small wren landed repeatedly on the pillow next to my head and hopped about mouse-like. Finally, I figured out how to push out the window, and while I stood by the window, the bird approached, chirped, and flew out to freedom. I was able to get only a few brief moments on video. It was one of the most amazing moments of my bird life. A winter wren, can you believe it? She writes.
No, I can't believe it. And I'm so envious. And like Jane was looking at me and my mouth was like wide open, like I was catching flies there. That is really awesome. I'm so curious, like, how did it get in? Like, what was it thinking? I mean, that's wonderful. And I want to see the video. So send it to me.
Yeah, or post it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page.
Yeah.
And we'll see if we can pass it along. Jane, thank you for that. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's the Fall Bird Show on Vermont Edition today, so it's all birds, all hour, with bird diva Bridget Butler. I'm going to read you two questions here. One from Donna in Thetford Center, Bridget, who says, I'm concerned about the dearth of birds in my area for the past 2 to 3 weeks. The silence has been deafening. Crows and jays are around, but few to none of the usual resident species. We're on the edge of the forest with a stream running through and have a lot of berries that are usually magnets for many species. Others here in the Upper Valley are reporting the same thing. Matt says, my mother, who lives in Waitsfield, has noted that the birds that normally are around her house have reduced by 80 to 90% in the last month or so. This includes resident birds as well as migratory ones. And Diane is on the line with us from Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Hi, Diane. You're noticing fewer birds as well?
Exactly. I also live in a heavily wooded, or I have a heavily wooded backyard. And I normally have lots of chickadees, nuthatch, titmice, and cardinals flitting around in my backyard. And I just recently put my feeder back up, and I haven't had a single bird come to it. And normally when I put it out in the fall, within 15, 20 minutes, I'll have birds at it. And this year I haven't had any for about a week, week and a half.
Bridget, what gives?
It's okay. It's okay. If I could reach across and hold everybody's hand right now and just say, don't panic, don't panic. So here's what's really cool. If we're tracking birds, and we do that through eBird, and some people do that in their own journals, right, online, one of the other things that we want to make sure that we're tracking are things like weather, and then things like seed and cone crops, right, food supply. So what I'm thinking about this year, and typically we see this slide in bird feeder activity in the late summer and early fall, because there's lots and lots of food available. Like, everything's coming in right now, right? So flowers are going to seed, trees are going to seed, the cone crop is huge right now, berry crop is really pretty good right now. Then you got to think insects. And this year, especially that dry weather, we've had a peak in a lot of our forest pests. So you'll notice lots of leaf cutter insects. We have forest tent caterpillars. So this is the time of year when insect spikes as well. So lots of food available, which means they're not going to come to your feeder. So like I said earlier, feeders are a small part of a bird's diet. So they're going to go for the wild stuff before they go for your feeder. So it's okay that they're not there right now.
But is it a weird year? Because a lot of people are feeling like this is outside the normal range of when things might have, you know, a sort of peak and trough.
But Jane, what is a lot of people?
Well,
and is that, I
don't know,
so
7 or 8
three,
have emailed
right?
us. Yeah.
So here's the thing that we need to do is that we need to learn how to use some of the resources out there to kind of look at trends over a longer period of time. And people hate it when I say this. because they're like, well, I'm seeing it, so this is what it is. Or climate change is happening, and this is my truth, and it's all doom and gloom. And granted, yes, bird populations are in decline. We know that. But when we look at these little snapshots of what's happening in our backyard, what we have to do is kind of take this cosmic zoom out and really dig into some science. So what I could say to you is, one, make sure you're putting all these sightings on eBird. If you haven't already created an eBird account, then please do that and start putting these things in. Two, take part in Project Feeder Watch, which is a fall time citizen science project that's sponsored by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology that does just this, that looks at trends of feeder specific birds. Then go and dig into eBird. It is so much fun. You can get lost there for hours in a really good way because you're letting your brain absorb some really great science. And look at some of these birds that you normally have in your backyard at this time of year, and you can pull up graphs and things that can show you over 5 years what the trend is for, say, chickadees or nuthatches during this time of year. And I'm pretty sure that you're going to see a drop in observations. One of the things that I do during the fall birding season, I don't go into the deep woods to bird, unless it's a spruce fir, like coniferous woodland, right? I'm going to go to edges. I'm going to go to like shrub scrubby habitat because that's where the food source is. So the birds have also moved and shift where they're at. They may just not be in your backyard. Maybe they're like right down the street. Maybe they're in my yard. I don't know.
Yeah, you seem to have all of them. Bridget, I almost forgot to ask you. So you were telling us that you've been invited to be an instructor for the White Pine Program's New England Bird Language Intensive. You're going to be teaching bird language.
Yes.
How do you speak bird?
So this is like... This is a long journey for me. So bird language, this concept came from tracker and naturalist John Young, who studied with another famous tracker, Tom Brown. And then a guy named Dan Gardoqui, who is co-founder of the White Pine School in Maine. And Dan and John wrote a book a couple years back called What the Robin Knows. And it's really all about reading the different voices of birds and understanding what they're saying to you about what's going on in the landscape around you. So they've kind of broken down bird song or bird voices, not only by breeding, but more specifically by what you can hear in alarms and body language that will key you into different things. And I got a chance to go and take this 4-day bird language intensive last year, and it really blew my mind because it slowed me right down. And I think this is where I'm starting to think about how I can see really unique, spectacular things wherever I'm at when it comes to birds. And I'll give you an example. Carolina wrens, I have them all over my backyard. Love it. Tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle. They're just constant, right? So we know them. I've gotten to know where they hang out in my yard. What I do this spring is part of my bird language kind of practice is to go out with a cup of coffee in the morning and sit, just listen, watch, draw a map of my yard, make some notes. I get to know the usual suspects and what their patterns of behavior are. And by doing that, then there's like this invisible thread that kind of connects me and this bird. And so this past summer, I'm out in my backyard. Kids are jumping on the trampoline. Carolina wrens are going off because they're used to our activity, right? Tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle. Then it switches to an alarm, very chattery, very harsh. And it's coming from over at my neighbor's backyard. And I look up in time to see a fox slinking along the edge of the woods that are at right at the edge of my neighbor's yard, right along the brook. And the wren is posted up looking down at that fox giving the alarm call. So that's kind of what bird language can do. It's this whole kind of practice of slowing down, learning to read body language, and learning to take a deeper dive on some of the alarm calls in a way so that you can say, this is an alarm call that is like, oh, I'm not so worried. And this is an alarm call that's like, yeah, I'm really worried about this fox that's moving through and might be interested in finding my nest.
Well, it's neat to think that you can sort of figure out what else is happening in the environment by keying into what the birds are saying and doing.
Yeah. And then you can also pay attention to how birds move through the landscape. And it when you're especially when you're sitting still and you allow everything to come back in around you, and then things start to happen. You know where to look and how to look because the birds are telling you based on how high up off the ground they are or in the direction that they're looking. I had another experience with catbirds and robins alarming, and they weren't looking at me. And I was like, all right, they're not looking at me. Who are they looking at? They were looking at this juvenile Merlin who looked miserable because all the other catbirds and robins were dive bombing him. But I knew where to look because I had looked at what the birds were telling me.
Let's go to Richard, who's calling in from Essex, New York. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Yes, hi.
Hey.
Good afternoon. I was interested in knowing if you could tell us, I understand that the snow geese have a big migratory path along the lake or across the lake, and that there's a big way station around Pointe aux Roches.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could tell us what time of year would be the best time to go see that?
I can, and I'm actually doing a snow goose extravaganza bird trip with the folks from St. Albans Recreation this year. So normally I target those trips to go see the snow geese around the second week in October through maybe the second week of November. And what's really interesting is one of the spots that's been a hot spot in Vermont for years, the Dead Creek Wildlife Management Area, which, by the way, Jane, has a new visitor center. Like, so exciting. So Dead Creek down in the Addison area, that's a really great spot to go. There are a couple of other areas that you can leapfrog on the back roads around there to pick them up. But the place that I like to go now, especially since I live up in St. Albans, is come around the north end of the lake and then drive the edge of Lake Champlain down south and just hit
on the north, on the New York side,
on
or the
New
Vermont
York
side,
yeah, on the New York side, and we're getting tens of thousands of geese over there. So that Pointe aux Roches State Park is a really good spot. There are a couple of fields there that have been really super productive, and you can get up so close. Like, I've taken my kids a couple times over there, and man, just pile the car with snacks and all kinds of good stuff, and you roll the windows down, and you can hear them and you can see them right from your car.
The snow geese are a nice entry point into birding too, because, you know, whether you're there or in at Dead Creek in Addison, if they're up close next to the fence, you can really see them, and it's a wonderful thing. And Bridget, this is something that you've emphasized for as long as I've known you, is that it's a low bar for entry, a low barrier to entry to being a birder. You can do it as casually or as you know, sort of intensively as you want.
Yes, it's there. It's out there. And what amazes me is everybody has a bird story to tell. And, you know, thinking about, especially this time of year, like you said, snow geese are an easy entry point. Winter birds that come to your feeder are an easy entry point. And then as you get ready for spring, you can take on some of the jewels of the forest, all the warblers and the sparrows and things that come back. And it's just never ending. I don't like to be called an expert because I always feel like I have so much more to learn.
What have you learned this year that's really intrigued you?
Oh my gosh,
I know, now I've
Jane.
Put you on the spot.
Oh,
I'll tell you then while you're thinking. The thing that for me is so exciting every year is my husband and I have noticed that we can pinpoint, I mean, we don't know when it's coming because we're not paying it that close attention, but we see the day the red-winged blackbirds arrive.
Yes.
It's like one day they're not there and the next day they are,
and
you see them all over the place.
Yes.
I love that.
And so timing, like the timing of those things is really just amazing. And if you're keeping track of that in a journal at home, you know when to start to look. And you know what? That's what bird guides like me do, right? We do our homework, we study, we learn what's going to be out there. And then everyone's like, oh, it's so amazing that you know all this stuff. It's like, no, really, I just did my homework because there are all these great people reporting when birds are coming in now. Technology has allowed us to so much more easily communicate where we're seeing things and when. I think my hotspot this year was probably watching a male and female cardinal do the beak kiss thing in late spring. And then through my practice of sitting and doing my sit spot for bird language, I discovered the nest nearby. And I read that kissing is a sign that is a suitable area for nesting. And it was all because I just slowed down and enjoyed what I had right in my backyard.
That's probably a good place to end. Slow down, enjoy what's in your own backyard.
It's right there.
By the way, you can get more Bridget Butler at Bird Diva Consulting. Her website is birddiva.com. Bridget, it's always such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, everybody, for calling in.